It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Last week, we shared a conversation I had with the Baltimore civil rights pioneer Helena Hicks, whose participation in a 1955 sit-in helped to desegregate the Reed's drugstore chain. This morning, the story of another largely unsung civil rights pioneer. I spoke with her last January. Her name is Gloria Richardson. She was born in 1922, and she was active in the early years of the civil rights movement, a time when men largely overshadowed the women who were playing pivotal roles as activists and organizers. Now living in New York City, Gloria Richardson was front and center of the fight for equal rights on Maryland's Eastern Shore in the 1960s, where she helped organize the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, which later came to be known as the Cambridge Movement.
I was born in Baltimore, actually, and we lived there till I was about 8 or 9 years old. The Depression came along, and my father closed his drugstore in Baltimore, and the family, our household, moved down to Cambridge. He reopened a drugstore there. We went and lived with my mother's parents. I grew up in a segregated school system. I also was in kind of a bubble because Cambridge, that part of Eastern Shore, was kind of fortunate. There were no lynchings, although they were in other towns. Jim Crow kinds of things were, if you knew your place in that society, you know, it was very even. I knew not to go into the, I don't know how I knew that, but I knew where I wasn't supposed to go. My grandfather had a grocery store and was an undertaker and city councilman. I almost forgot that. And so I think it was two kinds of bubbles. The whole second ward, because Cambridge was divided into wards. One black ward, four white wards. So we were, in terms of churches and stores and things, almost a whole separate little city. They respected and were heavily involved in the stories of both Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. I think you grew up knowing they were alternatives, whether they presented themselves in Cambridge or not. I think Frederick Douglass's plantation was about 10 minutes' ride from Cambridge. And Harriet Tubman, I think they have it a little wrong now, but everybody in Cambridge even today knows what other little town she was from. So we kind of grew up with that history. And that may, now that we're talking about it, have also been, you know, internally part of that background of why Cambridge blew up so much.
In the early 1960s, activists from groups like CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, worked to desegregate restaurants along Route 40. It was called the Route 40 Project. Route 40 was the primary route between Washington, D.C. and New York. Nearly all of the restaurants and facilities on that road were only open to whites. Those sit-ins from Baltimore to Wilmington, Delaware, led to the creation of the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee.
Initially, it was for public accommodations, but they had been going doing the Route 40 demonstrations, CORE, the Student Nonviolent Action Committee, and I guess the NAACP, in that Baltimore, Washington area. And because they were after Governor Taws, who was governor at that time, and he lived down on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, they rented buses and were going down the Eastern Shore. My family got involved because my uncle was a bail bondsman, and they did some demonstrations up and down the Eastern Shore until Crisfield, Maryland. And on the way back, they had been arrested and whatever, but on going back to Baltimore, my cousin said to them, you know, it's totally segregated in Cambridge. Why don't you all stop off there? And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee sent two field secretaries. And they began to have rallies and meetings. And surprisingly, in the black community, just hundreds of people went out. They had them in the churches. And out of that came the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee. And because my daughter was involved in the sit-ins, then I got involved. And it was the first adult because the high school and grammar school kids had almost shut down the town. And then the black preachers decided that they would have quiet and peace and then negotiate whatever it was they wanted for the stores to open up. You know, 1 week passed, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, till finally the kids were just totally demoralized And because the parents had backed them in the beginning, we went down to Atlanta to ask Nick if, even though we were adults, you know, could we form a chapter?
When Richardson organized the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee, it was the first adult group affiliated with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. At that point, she was in her late 30s. I asked her about the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's authorizing her to form the first adult organization affiliated with SNCC.
When the high school and grammar school kids were out on the public accommodations and their parents in the community supported them, there used to be a group of adults that met. I think it was the first time white folks knew that some of the black folks owned their homes, because they were also putting up bail and stuff from their property and whatever. I guess it's that thing about the white gaze doesn't see you, because certainly it was registered downtown. You know, it wasn't a big secret. So they were 9 or 10 people. And then there were other people that had small businesses, and they used to go to meetings at my uncle's house. So the adult CNAC grew out of that.
I asked her what sort of actions the groups did.
We were having mass rallies and picketing, and also the young people were involved. But at one point, I decided that there were greater issues, or felt that there were greater issues than just the public accommodations. So I set up a survey, and the kids distributed it. And we found out that actually public accommodations was the last on a list of about 5. It was better housing, school desegregation, ability to go to the hospital. So they were like 4 or 5 other things. And of course, jobs. That's what we presented to the city council then, were those 5 issues, and to work on them. And that's what started the general movement.
And in 1963, after a couple of years of these actions and protests, there was violence in Cambridge.
Oh, yes. It was consistent violence every night. When we were doing demonstrations and picketing and marchings, we did that legally, according to law, although there were some arrests. But then at night, when the white gangs would come out and shoot and set off Molotov cocktails, the men in the second ward that were black, you know, responded to that. So it was almost like 2 movements going on. Eventually, the governor had to send in the National Guard to keep calm while the negotiations were going on.
And were the precepts of this organization based on Dr. King's work in nonviolent protest?
No, I mean, we didn't work within the frame of Martin. In the first place, he was young. Nobody knew much about him. He was just another civil rights worker. And I don't really think the black people or the black men in Cambridge would have sat there and let them, you know, destroy wherever they lived and things like that. Or beat them up or shoot at them or so.
There was a lot of violence during the years of the Cambridge movement.
Oh, yes.
61, 62, up through 63.
I mean, 60, there was... Up through 63. Because even with the treaty that we, quote unquote, that we signed, one of the whereases in there was that if things went according to the agreement, that we would suspend demonstrations for an indefinite time.
And it ended in what's known as the Treaty of Cambridge, and some real serious changes did take place following those protests.
Yes. The agreement was signed off on by Robert Kennedy and Burg Marshall. It included some of the history that had gone on in those last 2 or 3 years, and also the total desegregation of schools, that the city council and the city fathers would agree to apply to the National Housing Authority to put in 200 units of housing, which they did, and some side things that went on. They couldn't come out now, ward, and destroy property and put something up. It was an urban renewal program nationally, but in the case of our agreement, it had to stop at the beginning of the second ward. So that enabled them to put money into doing some kinds of building in the other wards, and they would have to hire blacks because it was federal money.
What do you remember the most about segregated life in Cambridge that you encountered as a young person, and then when you returned to take care of your relatives as a young mother yourself?
I don't think I paid too much attention to it, because I was living in an entirely black world. Wherever we went visiting friends, you know, Baltimore, Washington, New York, most of them, I guess, were professionals, except to know that you were being discriminated against. I don't think, it wasn't something I worried about every day. If everything was going okay, that may have been because I didn't have to worry financially. But I had always been brought up to know that I had to remember that I was able to live well because of the clients and the customers that my family had in whatever they were doing. Also, the lawyer and a doctor. I was kind of raised to look down on so-called middle-class blacks and leap over them into, you know, those people that if they were spending their money here, you know, you wouldn't be able to do this and that.
I want to move now to the March on Washington. When you were on the stage with Dr. King, what was your planned role?
I don't think they did not want me there. I had about a 2 weeks leeway before they invited me. I wasn't really interested because I really thought people should lay down in the streets of Washington and just stop it. But in any event, I went. They picked me up late. I was late getting on the stage. And when I got there, they had removed my chair with the banner. And Lena Horne and Josephine Baker were sitting on the left side where they were taking me, and they said to me, "They moved your chair, you should raise hell." So I said, no, I don't need any of this, because we were in the midst of getting ready to sign that the first agreement anyhow. And so I went in the back of the group, because there was a lawyer back there that I wanted to talk to about some of the problems in Cambridge. So that's what I did. They announced the name, and everybody around me said, no, go up there. So I went up there, and when I got the microphone, I said, hello. And when I was waiting for the applause to die down, they took the mic away from me, because I was going to say, sit there. Don't move from here for the next day till they pass the civil rights bill, which really wasn't that adequate anyhow. But that's what had, you know, that was the scene.
This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." "Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
In 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a very different figure than the person he's grown to be in the light of history.
Actually, Martin was just like, I guess, any young man. He did not have the kind of fame that he has now. And I guess that's because he was less controversial. I know when we really pushed the economic stuff, he sent one of his key people to see if I would meet with him and explain to him about the economic goals that we were pushing. Because initially, when SNCC left the first time back in the public accommodation days, people wanted him to come to Cambridge to speak. And when they invited him, he said no. He was booked for at least 2 years. And that we would have to pay him $3,000. Well, we were a little tiny, 2,000 or 3,000 people, and we were not going to be able to have any $3,000 to give him. And actually, that was a good thing for us, because then we had to do it ourselves. And so that's when people started, and older people started activating and doing things and pushing things and coming to the meetings.
When you see the unrest that unfolded in Baltimore in response to the death of Freddie Gray while he was in police custody in April of 2015, what was your initial reaction?
Oh, I was glad. You know, Baltimore had been so suppressed for so long. People had been running around saying, well, you know, if you don't vote, you can't get freedom. Well, that's a lie, too. I think Black Lives Matter is just tremendous. I was invited to be on a panel with Ms. Hamer and Ms. Parks. They had this convening up at Columbia University. And it was just great. They were young, you know, young people, not teenagers, but young people up there. And I just thought what they have done so far is great. I mean, this is the second time around, so what do people expect?
And what do you think the priorities of the Black Lives Matter movement should be? Do you think that they are?
Well, I think it's so varied, because you have people across the country where some of it is, it was the actual Black Lives Matter thing, but they're into pretty much everything except voting, which I hope they don't get into. The school, which I didn't realize that it was still bad in Ivy League schools till you had this, till you had the 4 or 5 schools where students were demonstrating against. I don't even know if their parents knew it.
Sure, Yale University and so on.
But I mean, they seem to be, you know, anything that's discriminatory or racist.
You've mentioned voting a couple of times. You said that you hope the Black Lives Matter movement doesn't get involved in voting. Why not?
Oh, yeah, no, because I don't think they make. Look at Baltimore. All the government was black. Yet the white folks in the other wards didn't even know the National Guard had been there. And what was that, 2 or 3 days of just looked like pure hell.
Gloria Richardson, one of the organizers of the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee on the Eastern Shore in the 1960s, part of what came to be known as the Cambridge Movement. She spoke to me last January from her home in New York City. We've got more information on our website, including an iconic image of Gloria Richardson pushing a bayonet away from a protesting crowd. That's at WIPR.org/Marilyn Morning. Coming up, we revisit a conversation with Baltimore author Kathy Flan about her latest collection of short stories called Get a Grip. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Everything gonna be all right one day. Everything gonna be all right. Everything gonna be